Hi, everybody. I want to ask you to come on in and take a seat or hang out in the back. We're going to start our program. Thank you all for coming. I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV and Reason.com. Tonight we're going to have a nice fast-paced debate that is keying off of our July cover story in the magazine by Damon Root. Conservatives versus libertarians, the debate over judicial activism by his former allies. Let me introduce our panelists and just go through our kind of setup for tonight. First is Nate Root, who's an editor at Reason Magazine and a longtime writer and analyst of Legal Trends. Okay, so we have Gene Meyer of the Federalist Society and then Doug Kendall of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who I guess both of you guys are in the story as well, right?
Yeah.
So you guys can fight about how Damon misrepresented your points of view or misunderstood obvious basic facts. But what we're going to do today is first we're going to do three rounds and then open it up for questions. Damon's going to talk about the main points in his story. Gene and Doug will respond to that, and then after that we're going to go through a kind of lightning round about what is most interesting to each of the panelists about the recent Supreme Court decisions that have been released this week, or late last week and this week, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the Kagan nomination and what that means, if anything, to the future of the American experiment. So, Damon, why don't you take it away and let it rip.
Well, thank you, Nick, for the introduction. Thank you to everyone for coming out tonight. Also, thank you to co-panelists. Very humbled to be on stage with two very distinguished legal experts, so I appreciate your participation. I think we can all agree that the last few years have been pretty good for the conservative legal movement. 2 years ago, in the Heller case, the Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment applies. The Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms, not a collective one. Last year, in the Citizens United case, the Supreme Court struck down portions of Kaine Feingold for violating free speech in the name of campaign finance reform. And then just this very week, in McDonald versus Chicago, the Supreme Court applied the Second Amendment to the states using the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And this is a great decision because it, although there's some problems with it, it gives the Second Amendment its place among the Bill of Rights, and also recognizes, to some degree, the text and history of the 14th Amendment, which was designed to prevent predatory state governments from violating individual rights. So these are our big conservative wins. But at the same time, they've revealed some really fundamental divisions within the conservative legal movement. And that's really what the story is about, particularly divisions between libertarians and conservatives over the issue of judicial review or the issue of what's the proper role of the courts in our society. Now, libertarians, this is speaking generally, there's going to be conservatives who feel differently, libertarians who feel differently, but libertarians, speaking generally, favor an aggressive legal system, aggressive courts, aggressive judiciary, which is striking down unconstitutional laws, which is going after misguided precedent. The libertarians generally favor a legal system where the courts act as what James Madison called an impenetrable bulwark against the tyranny of the majority. Conservatives, on the other hand, favor judicial restraint. And I think the figure who is best represents this, and I think I would argue is perhaps the most influential figure in the conservative legal movement, is Judge Robert Bork. And Bork, of course, is famous as a distinguished legal scholar, as a best-selling author, and also as a spectacularly unsuccessful Supreme Court nominee. And Bork, he in his book, The Tempting of America, he argues that the first principle of the American system isn't individual rights, it's majority rule. And what this means, and what he writes, is that in wide areas of life, majorities are entitled to rule, if they wish, simply due to the fact that they are majorities. And so you can see the contrast there with this idea that the courts should, libertarian idea that the courts should be standing up against a tyranny of the majority, with a conservative view which says that the courts should be deferring to the will of the majority, should be deferring to the wisdom and judgment and expertise of legislative majorities. And so if we now think about these three major conservative legal victories at the Supreme Court, you can see where Bork's majoritarian judicial restraint has caused some problems for conservatives. One of the most trenchant criticisms of the Heller gun rights case actually came from a leading legal conservative. Judge Harvey Wilkinson of the Fourth Circuit, who's a widely respected conservative judge. And he attacked Heller in very strong terms. He actually compared Justice Scalia's majority opinion in Heller to Roe versus Wade. And I don't have to tell you that that's pretty much the worst thing one conservative judge can say to another. And he said that in Heller, Justice Scalia asked the American people to do what conservatives had long told them not to do, which was to turn to the courts for political solutions. The conservative view, best represented in my view by Robert Bork's argument, is that if you have a problem with the law, you go to the ballot box, not to the courtroom. And that's something where I think we're all familiar with conservatives advocating for judicial restraint, judicial deference to popular majorities. And yet, in Heller, and in Citizens United, and this week in McDonald, you have the Supreme Court, who are unelected, these platonic guardians, if you will, not accountable to the voters, striking down popularly enacted laws. So why, if Bork is correct, why shouldn't the lawmakers here in Washington or in Chicago get to set gun control policy? Why should these black robe, unelected black robe justices be in the business of striking down these laws?
Women.
So the libertarian view is not susceptible to this particular line of attack, because libertarians are not concerned with the majority, they're concerned with liberty. And they're concerned with preventing the courts, or with the courts preventing the tyranny of the majority from overtaking American rights. So just to sum up quickly, what I think we're seeing now in the legal system, and I'd hopefully we can get into this in the Q&A particularly, is a gradual receding of Judge Bork's influence and a bit of an ascent of the more libertarian arguments. And now, obviously, this is a slow process, and one view is not triumphing over the other, but we're starting to see conservatives, they're still talking a majoritarian judicial restraint talk, but they're starting to selectively walk more in the libertarian, principled judicial engagement route. And in my view, to really understand both the conservative legal movement, which I think people on the left and the right will want to do, as well as to understand what's going on with the courts, you know, you need to understand this division. And so with that, thank you.
Great. Thanks, Gene.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. I very, very much enjoyed your article, even if I had a couple differences with it. And I thought about wearing black today in honor of Nick, but at the end I decided not to. I guess I would say this.
Yeah, close.
Okay. I guess I would say that the key question with libertarians and conservatives in terms of judicial nominations and what's distinguished them for the most part, in my view, from, I guess I would say, the Justice Brennan view of the court, is while they differ quite significantly, both take very seriously that they're trying to interpret the Constitution and its text. They're both consider that enterprise a major enterprise and a difficult enterprise, and indeed it should not come as a surprise that the agreement will not always be widespread on some issues. But that is the enterprise that I think in the whole conservative libertarian area everybody is serious about. I don't mean to say that nobody on the left is serious about that, but I do think there's been a lot of writing on the left that has said there are a lot of other factors, and that really is not to be dominant. So I don't find some of the arguments about how sharp the split's going to be as that persuasive. I think there will be significant divisions on significant issues, but I think even where there are those differences, they are going to be differences that can be argued from principle, and I think there will be agreement in many of the cases. I don't think, I do think you will find in almost all cases that there will be some sharp dissents from, as you gave the example of Judge Wilkinson, because interpretation's not easy, and he felt very differently from what most of the conservatives felt, and you know, also I think probably what most of the libertarians felt. And the idea in all these cases is that we have a constitutional structure that has over 200 years been a major contributor in keeping this country a free country. that is not an abstract theory. It is something which is integral to the nature of truly separated powers that the framers worked very hard to devise. And having a court that is serious about the interpretive role as opposed to trying to, so to speak, get the right result is essential to reaching essential to supporting the type of structures that enable the society overall to remain free, because the key problem is, you know, a lot of times the rulers are going to have mixed motives at best in terms of free society, and the structures of society are going to be what helps guide us.
Thank you. Doug?
Thanks, and thanks for having me here. And I do want to recommend to everyone that if you haven't read Damon's article, it's terrific, and I think everyone here should. I was called for the article because my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center, filed a brief in the McDonald case on behalf of scholars that range from Jack Balkin and Richard Ains, who are two very liberal constitutional law professors, to Steve Calabresi and Randy Barnett, who are two pretty conservative constitutional law professors, all arguing for incorporation of the Second Amendment through the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, arguing that that is the textually most appropriate and historically accurate way of protecting substantive fundamental rights against intrusion by the states. That's an argument that got voice only truly through Justice Thomas's opinion in the court in the ruling of McDonald, and we can talk about that in the next round. The point I'd make, just building off of that, is that I disagree a little bit with Gene about this dichotomy between conservatives taking the text and history of the Constitution seriously and liberals not. I think if you look at the scholarship, probably the most comprehensive attempt to articulate the original meaning of the Constitution is Akilah Maher's book, America's Constitution, a biography, and I'd recommend that also to everybody in the room. And my organization was actually started to ensure that progressives take text and history just as seriously as conservatives do, more in some cases, I think. I take Damon's point about this being largely a debate about judicial review and judicial restraint versus judicial activism, but I'd actually disagree with it to this extent. I think if you look at the really profound differences between conservatives and libertarians, and I saw them up close in the McDonald case, where they're just the warring sides between purported conservatives was really kind of breathtaking, being on one part of that debate. But I think if you look more closely, that the debate is really a more fundamental one about what we want American society to be. And you know, if you look in the Bush administration, there was a dramatic increase in the size of the federal government, and a deliberate one, and one that was designed to expand the powers, particularly in national security, but in other areas as well, of the federal government. And libertarians want to break and rip all that down. And then there's this very fundamental disagreement about individual rights. The Borkian conservatives really want to, you know, take away the rights that have already been recognized and don't want to go beyond those. And then the libertarians, under the Privileges or Immunities Clause and other provisions of the Constitution, want to dramatically expand at least some rights. And so I think that's really what the divide is about. It's about where we want our governmental system to go and what rights we want to have as individuals. And I think it is hard, and the point I made in Damon's article is that those divisions are easy to paper over when you're playing defense against a liberal court and you can unite against what you label liberal judicial activism. It's much harder when you have a majority conservative court and majority conservative lower federal judiciary. You really have to decide what you want, where you want the courts to go. And I think that's an unbelievably difficult choice for conservatives to make right now, and I certainly don't expect you'll probably take much of my advice or care much about my advice about it. But the one thing I'd say is that I think a great contribution of conservatives to legal thought has been a version of originalism or the idea that we really have to take text and history seriously. It's not original to conservatives. It's obviously building off of the work of liberal justices, including Hugo Black. But I think it's an incredibly important thing that conservatives have emphasized and pushed all of us towards. And I guess the thing I would say about that is, and the brief we filed at McDonald's shows it, I think the libertarians have the better of the answer on the individual rights question. I think the Privileges or Immunities Clause and the framers of the 14th Amendment really did want to protect individual liberties, economic as well as personal liberties. I think the Borkian or the Bushian conservatives probably had the better argument about federal powers. It's the federal government's powers were intended to be broad. That's why we replaced the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution. There's been 8 separate amendments that have been added to federal power. We've constitutionalized the progressive income tax. We've done a lot of things to change and expand the powers of the federal government. I don't think you're going to win that argument either based on originalism or based on where the country is and is going. And so my little piece of advice is that, you know, you look seriously at, you know, that your purported method, which is originalism, and I think that kind of provides the best answer between the somewhat warring parties.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's, for the next round, and we'll come back to this in the Q&A, you can bring up any points. Each of you pick one of the Supreme Court rulings from this past term and say why you think it's the most important, the most disastrous, or in the end, you know, just how, what is momentous about it or not. David, why don't you start?
I would, following up on Doug, I would pick the McDonald versus Chicago decision of this week. I think the fact that the Second Amendment is taking the place it deserves among the other protections in the Bill of Rights and being applied to the states is very important. I'd also like to single out, as you mentioned, Justice Thomas's concurrence, which I think is a remarkable piece of legal scholarship and historical scholarship, and I would encourage you all to read that. One of the things that was interesting in the run-up to McDonald is that, as you mentioned, conservative and libertarian groups were fighting openly about constitutional interpretation and strategy, and it had to do with should the Second Amendment be applied to the states via the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which has been a dead letter in American law since 1873 and a horrible decision called the Slaughterhouse Cases, or should it be done through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which is, for the last century or so, is how these things have been brought about. And the principled, in my view, the principled originalist argument is the one that the libertarians made, and it's the one that CAC made as well, which is that if you follow the text and history of the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause needs to be revived and resurrected, and that is the method to do so. So that Justice Thomas writes this, and none of the 4 other conservatives who make up the majority, no one is challenging his arguments. So this stands as an unchallenged concurrence. It's there in the case books for future generations to read and discover. And so I think that's just fabulous and very important.
Yeah, I also think that's very important. I think that we may look back at the Citizens United as being really key. And one of the questions there, you mentioned Bork, and I'll use him as an example here. He's talked a lot about how the most critical part of the First Amendment, he's always believed, was the was political speech. And whatever one exactly one says about that, certainly political speech is critical, because at the end of the day, if you can fool with that, you may be able to fool with anything. So what we do in that area is very important. There's no doubt that Citizens United created a significant change in the direction the court seemed to be heading in that area. So that would be my pick.
Do you have any reason to believe that Citizens United will actually change the way that political campaigns are funded or run? Or is it mostly a kind of legal shot across the bow?
My guess is it's more a legal shot across the bow, because one of the features of campaign finance is that it's a lot like having a river trying to get to an ocean, and all the campaign finance rules are dams blocking the river, but the water will still get to the ocean. And I don't, I think that's, there is a secondary problem, though, which is that the power that people are objecting to, people using with financial gifts, could arguably be considered that it's going to be used in some way or other. If you really limit very effectively ways to get out a message with money, essentially the media is going to have greatly increased power to choose what messages get out. Now, that's even more complicated today because the media is more splintered than it used to be. But somehow or other, messages are going to get out.
And that may also help explain why the media, or mainstream media, seem to be really horrified at Citizens United, because it actually might have robbed them of some potential power.
I will say, and by the way, I forgot my disclaimer, so I'll get it in now. Federal Side does not take position, so if I, by mistake, express an opinion somewhere here, it is purely my own.
You're a man, without opinion. Doug, what about what for you is the big case?
I'm a man with many opinions, and I'll state them. I think the two prior panelists have identified what are clearly the only two cases that are in the running for the most important cases of the term. I have different reactions to the descriptions of those, though. I completely agree with Damon about the importance of the McDonald ruling. I think if we are to incorporate portions of the Bill of Rights, the Second Amendment, and with the Second Amendment recognizes an individual right, which the court held in Heller. In other words, if Heller is right, then McDonald has to be right. It can't be that there's portions, substantive portions of the Bill of Rights that don't get incorporated. And I think the majority got that question right. And I think Damon's right that Justice Thomas's opinion is a remarkable recitation of the history of the 14th Amendment. And, you know, close your eyes and imagine that opinion being written by Thurgood Marshall rather than Clarence Thomas. If it wasn't about gun rights, I think that's, you could have seen that opinion and wished for that opinion. It's a pretty remarkable opinion. I have a completely different view on Citizens United. I think it's an awful ruling. I think it gets the text and history of the Constitution exactly wrong. I think there's a history going back from the dawn of the Republic and John Marshall's opinions that says that corporations are different from we the people, that corporations are never mentioned in the text of the Constitution. There's a 220-year history broken up only by a little portion of the Lochner era before now, where we have always treated corporations differently from we the people. And I think the opinion gets that wrong, and it's to the great detriment to our democracy.
Okay, let's talk about the topic du jour, I guess, Elena Kagan. Damon, is her nomination worth talking about, and why?
Maybe only to complain about the confirmation hearing so far. I think I join most people in the country being underwhelmed and disappointed, particularly that one of the few opinions that she's very clearly stated was that she thought the judicial confirmation process had become a charade and a joke, and is now participating in that charade herself. So that's, I think that's disappointing. One thing that really could be beneficial, and if it wasn't in the hands of the Senate, maybe that would be so, is that we could actually have real discussions about the Constitution, about American history, and about legal matters. But instead, you've got senators grandstanding and nominees refusing to answer questions. So it's about as important of an issue as you can imagine, someone who's going to sit on the Supreme Court and decide these very important cases, and yet we're treated to something that's very underwhelming. So.
Yeah, I do think there's something interesting going on. By the way, before I forget, I wanted to mention, I agree with you completely about Amar. I think I would strongly recommend his book to everyone here. I think it's the exception, not the rule, but I agree with you about the importance of that, and I'm very pleased with what you're doing in terms of trying to focus on originalism, because I think that's where the discussion should be. It was strikingly on that in the Heller case on both sides, and I think that's the type of discussion one should be having, however the case comes out. On Kagan, I would say there's the most interesting thing. I mean, I fear, among many things about the Judge Bork's hearings, one of the lessons that was clearly taken was, don't say anything, because people agreed the hearings were extremely interesting. But, you know, if you want to get confirmed, it's probably wiser to be quiet. But what I think is interesting about Kagan, about Sotomayor, is exactly the acceptance that originalism, or something like it, is the desirable way for judges to go about what they're doing, and I have high hopes that that will have an effect not only on the Supreme Court but on other courts as well.
I think there's something to Damon's criticism of the fact that there's now an entire script about that nominees follow in terms of not answering certain types of questions. I think that's kind of well established by judges of both parties that you can't talk about specific cases and cases that are likely to come. That said, I thought there was a really interesting change in the conversation about judicial confirmations this week in the Senate. I thought you had just about every Senate Democrat talking about and criticizing judicial activism. You had the Republican senators asking for it in some cases, asking whether General Kagan would be aggressive enough in striking down federal powers and extending Heller and things like that. And so the conversation we're having tonight, I think, was echoed to a little bit, to a little extent, on the Hill this week. And I thought, actually, General Kagan did a lot of things I was hoping she would do. She distanced herself from these ideas of living constitution. She expressed a firm commitment to the Constitution's text, history, and principles. And I thought she established, in some respects, a new model for what a progressive judicial nominee is. It talks about.
Thanks. And I guess now we'll open it up to questions. I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and ask the first one. And then when you do get called on, please let me come to you, and you can stand up, speak in the microphone, and identify yourself. Here, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Mark Tushnet, the Georgetown law professor, and one of the things that he said that I always found interesting was that, you know, in the long run, or in the big picture, the Supreme Court actually doesn't matter that much. That, I mean, it's generally a lagging indicator of where American society is, and it might have a little bit of effect, but it's not really a transformative part of American life. Is that totally nuts, or is that actually the way things are?
I wouldn't say it's totally nuts. There's something to the fact that the intellectual climate changes, and the law reflects that in terms of the civil rights movement is able to win major Supreme Court victories. That, you know, that's not something that the start of the civil rights revolution. That's something the civil rights movement starts at the beginning of the 20th century. So in fact, that there's society does change in some ways before the courts do. But I would disagree that it's that what the courts do just doesn't matter, because when, especially if we're talking about very bad decisions, just 5 years ago this month, the Kelo decision, where I think the Supreme Court got it disastrously and horribly wrong, we have this problem in New York, where I live, of these eminent domain abuses that are basically been greenlighted as in part following that decision. So those are real people's lives that are uprooted and are ruined by the power of the government, which is something that the courts have approved. So in some sense, the courts can do, you know, it's most important when it's doing damage, unfortunately.
Fred, I know that you want to ask a question, so let's start with you, and then we'll see if there's any oxygen left in the room.
Fred Smith, Conservative Enterprise. I'd like to defend in part and defer in part to Bork. Bork, anyone who's gone through the court hearing, the hearing process he went through, would obviously have a feeling that libertarian, legalist arguments that firmly assault majoritarian values is suicidal, that the libertarians would rather lose in principle than win any real victories for liberty. But on the earlier Bork, in the antitrust paradox, when he was asked the question about how would one deal with a law that says predatory pricing is illegal, he said you would not frontally assault that law. You would not say that Congress was stupid. You would basically say, well, fine, if you had a law against poltergeist, I would be willing to enforce it, but give me more instructions on how poltergeist should be identified. So he's basically arguing that indirect means of advancing liberty would be good. And I think that argument is a part of what explains the difference. Both libertarians and libertarians have realized that the Supreme Court, or haven't realized, that the Supreme Court reads the newspapers too. I think the challenge of those of us who are seriously trying to advance liberty is to recognize that we have to make a plausible case, communicate the case, that carefully crafted restrictions on liberty, which may go in all of your agreement on this, are not incompatible with any of the major cultural values of America. They're certainly not incompatible with libertarian values, they're not incompatible with the conservative value of stability, and they're not incompatible with the liberal value of justice, egalitarianism, and so on. But we've not made that case. Too often, I think, we try to convert people rather than to persuade them that libertarian policies or liberty policies can advance all of these cultural values. We did that with separation of church and state. We haven't yet done it with the separation of state and state, or the secular values that dominate America in the egalitarian world we live in. Comments, please.
I have a couple thoughts. I'm going to start out with response to one thing Doug said. I think judicial activism on the left, and this does tie in a bit. Judicial activism is often a confusing term. If you, in fact, have everybody trying to interpret the Constitution as best they can from the text, they're going to overturn a lot of laws if the Congress has decided to pass a lot of laws which violate the text. So it's a question of, it's not a question you can just add up numbers. You have to actually look at what laws were passed and whether, in fact, they were unconstitutional. I think that's one important point. I may come back to you.
I believe we had a question back here. Okay, let's do it.
Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute, and you'll excuse me if I'm not my normal coherent self. I just spent the last 48 hours watching and commenting on gavel-to-gavel coverage of these hearings, which I must say were more engaging than the Sotomayor hearings, at least. I don't know if that's saying much. One overriding theme that I got from the Kagan hearings was deference to Congress, to the political branches, that the courts aren't the only, indeed not even the principal arbiter of what is constitutional. And in thinking about this, it seems like, well, now all of a sudden, Borkians, I won't expand it to all conservatives, at least Borkians, are alarmed at some of the things that government is doing, and they would like, as I think Doug said, the courts to strike things down, whereas before the shoe was on the other foot. So is it not the case that some of this deferentialist perspective that's now to the fore in reaction to some of Obama's legislation or things that are going on the last years, the late Bush legislation certainly as well, and I don't mean to be partisan, is the chickens coming home to roost or the conservatives, the Borkians being hoisted on their own petard in terms of always pushing, equating judicial activism with courts that are active in not deferring to the political branches.
Doug, why don't you speak up?
Well, one thing I'd say to that, Ilya, is I think it's a fairly oft-repeated trend in United States history that courts become majorities by criticizing activism by the other ideological persuasion, and then once they have a majority, they become less enamored with judicial restraint. I think that happened. I mean, I think the thrust of the Roosevelt Court was judicial restraint and pushing back on the Lochner era, and then I think it evolved into something fairly different during the Warren Court, and I think that's what happens when, I mean, it's something that people like Richard Epstein and James Huffman and other people have been saying for decades within the conservative movement, that why are we getting all these great judges on the bench if they're just going to sit on their hands in some notion of judicial restraint? Well, those calls, I think, which you've been hearing for the last 25 years, but largely been ignored or not listened to, I think are just coming to the fore. And people, I think that's one of the things that the conservative legal movement is facing right now as they become, as they are in the majority on the Supreme Court and lower courts, is this temptation to do more than simply be restrained and not go further along the paths that the court was going, but rather to either go back in a pretty sharp direction or go off into another completely different direction. And I think that's the moment that the conservative legal movement is at, and I think that's why Damon's article is so informative and timely.
I don't think that that's what a good judge should do, and I'm obviously all human beings are subject to temptation, and certainly there'll be times when you're exactly right. But I think the idea is to try to figure. I mean, going back to something I said earlier, the role of the courts, it has a critical component in our structure of government, and that structure of government should not be taken lightly. It's the thing that has kept us a relatively free country for 200 years. Anybody can have a Bill of Rights. And most countries do, and they sound wonderful, but they don't get enforced. The governmental structure, the way in which you set ambition against ambition and thereby control it, is what makes things work. And what judges should do, and what I think some of these judges will do, is I don't think they're going to be trying to be restrained. I don't think they're going to be trying to be activists. I don't think they're going to be trying to set out a major agenda. I think they're going to be trying to get the cases right and under their judicial philosophy and understanding of what their proper role is. Now, that often can lead to frustrations and lead to very strange results. I mean, whether it's a Scalia arguing against flag burning or holding flag burning is constitutional or whatever the specific result may be. But that's what we need to be, we need to all have an eye out for judges. We cannot expect judges to be carrying out a libertarian agenda. We can't expect judges to be doing their best to interpret the Constitution. We can make very strong arguments that the proper interpretation of the Constitution calls for what we think, what we believe it should. But we shouldn't be looking to judges to be restrained or activist. That's the wrong type of way to look at it. And I think some of the conservative and libertarian differences that you talked about in the article won't be quite as strong as you may be predicting partly because I think in a lot of these cases they will find some agreement. On other cases, they won't. There will certainly be some differences.
If I can just respond quickly. I mean, I think I agree that originalism can and should be moderating force. That, and I think that's what I was getting at in my opening comments, that if you can get people as diverse as Randy Barnett and Jack Balkin and Steve Calabresi on the same brief making the same argument about what the text and history of the Constitution means, you know you have a pretty strong basis for advocating what you're advocating. On the other hand, and this is some of the challenges to the individual mandate and the federalism aspects of the healthcare legislation, if you have deep, deep divisions within conservative theorists and lawyers about a particular question, you know you're on pretty shaky ground as an original matter. And I guess that's a kind of discipline I think that will, that would be nice to see.
Can we get a lady question? To mix it up. Any ladies with questions? We want a lady question.
All right, so my question is actually a bit broader than that, and I'm sorry if I missed a wee bit of your discussion, but my question is, what do you think is the most important constitutional issue dealt with by the court this year? And also, I actually want to know what you think about our case on the PCAOB and the Appointments Clause and how that was handled.
We talked about both McDonald's and Citizens United as being, I think we both agree those are the two most important cases. But I think I think that case was important. I think it was partly important, at least in the way it came out, that the separation of powers I'm talking about putting all this emphasis on structural constitution. If we get back to the idea that you have to have reasonably clearly assigned responsibility, and you have to have the ability to do something in the executive about whatever your administration does so you can be held responsible, I think that case was a step in the right direction. What that case did for people who are not familiar with it, there's this board under Sarbanes-Oxley that was set up, I'm going to mess up the description, but it was set up to
manage accounting.
Yeah, basically manage accounting rules. And
accurately destroy the economy.
Yeah, well, that's another way of putting it. I mean, I don't like it the way,
And what happened was the board, as I understand it, that was set up basically was not really, you couldn't really fire it, you couldn't really do much about it, and it was a completely independent board. It wasn't, the SEC is already an independent agency, it's even independent essentially of that. And the court said that part of the bill does not pass muster, and the SEC has to be able to fire that board.
Let's, just to end things, the formal presentation, and then, we've got drinks hard and soft, everybody's going to be around so we can keep talking. Doug, talk a little bit about your outfit and what its goals are and what its aims are. And then, Gene, if you could talk a little bit about the Federalist Society. And Damon, maybe you can tell us what you have for lunch.
I gave a little snippet of this in the introduction. The organization is called Constitutional Accountability Center. It was launched in 2008, and with the idea of mission statement is it's a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to the progressive promise of the Constitution's text and history. And the idea is basically to shake up the debate about the Constitution in this country, say that Justice Scalia is right, that the text and history of the Constitution matters, but that in a whole host of areas it points in a progressive direction. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean, again, we won't side with
the McDonnell plaintiffs and follow the Constitution where it leads. The point basically is, you know, let's look carefully at the text and the history of the Constitution and let the chips fall where they may. We filed probably half dozen briefs in the Supreme Court this past term. We're working on three or four for the next term. The idea is to kind of map out the Constitution, flesh out some of the work that Akhil Amar has done, and really just kind of take seriously, clause by clause, issue by issue, what the text and history of the Constitution says.
Do you think, just briefly, do you think, is the current moment moving in a progressive direction, or are we in a period of conservative or libertarian dominance?
I think we're at a real tipping point, and I don't think we know where it's tipping. I think the court is, as we all know, basically as two camps, one fairly conservative, one fairly progressive, one justice who I don't know if he swings, but he's got a fairly idiosyncratic view of the Constitution, and we're most in many cases fighting over Justice Kennedy's vote. I think, you know, right now President Obama is basically replacing the aging, more progressive wing of the court. He's unlikely, in his first term at least, to replace any of the more conservative justices. So we're going to be in this period of equipoise, I think, for quite some time.
First of all, I really like the idea of what you're trying to do, because I think I do not think originalism is a specifically conservative or libertarian approach to the Constitution. I think it's an approach that makes sense for everyone to follow. And as I say, falls within the structure of our government. We should be fighting, you know, and we're going to be fighting a lot of battles, you know, over who's president, over who the legislature is. But to some degree, you know, the courts are ultimately, in part, a replacement for fists. We disagree. Let's, you know, I'm going to slug you. Well, we want a neutral and fair way to decide disputes, and we're not going to agree totally on constitutional interpretation. But it seems to me it's absolutely the right starting place, and so I applaud you for that.
Talk a little bit about the Federal Society.
Now, the Federal Society is basically founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of powers is central to our Constitution, and it's the role of the courts to say what the law is, not what it ought to be, which we've touched on a little bit here. And we've tried to do that. We have chapters at basically every law school in the country and in about 70 cities around the country. And what we have about 4,500 really active involved volunteers and about 40,000 people involved. But what we've really also tried to do is do as much as we can through debate and discussion. We, in our conferences, and you know, we run over 1,000 meetings a year at law schools, as many as we can. We run we do as much as we can through debates, and we think, just as I think the interpretation of the Constitution, I think originalism is a really good way to have that type of discussion. I think debate is something which is really the way in which people can actually learn, even though often debates get heated and sometimes they'll shed more heat than light, but it is a very, very good way to learn more.
Thanks. Damon, you've been on staff at Reason now for how long? Yeah, and I mean, talk a little bit about how you got interested. I mean, you've been carving out, I think, I certainly know I speak for Matt and myself as well as the staff. I mean, just really interesting stuff about legal history, about the idea of libertarian activism on the court and things like that. Why did you get interested in this stuff, and what's your next project in this vein?
I got interested in constitutional history in college, specifically studying the Civil War era with Barbara Fields at Columbia University, and so I got interested in the 14th Amendment there. I got interested in one of the things that was remarkable to me was how important Supreme Court decisions and interpretations of the law were, rather than just simply what the text said, so I got interested in learning about the courts. I read the Lochner decision as an undergraduate, and I thought it was correctly decided. That's obviously there's disagreement. Conservatives don't like that case. Liberals don't like it. Libertarians tend to champion it. And so I got interested in the idea that the Constitution protects economic liberty. I was sort of a budding libertarian, I guess, at that point, and those interests coincided.
And what are you working on next in terms of law study?
I'm continuing to look at the big Columbia University eminent domain case in New York, where we just had a terrible, terrible decision from New York's Court of Appeals. And I know that the property owners there are interested in trying to get the Supreme Court to hear that case, so they're working on that now. So following that and writing more about it.
Thank you. I want to thank our panelists, Doug Kendall, Gene Meyer, and Damon Root. Everybody's going to be here. Let's have some drinks and have more conversation, and maybe we'll get to fistfights. There are no courts in Reason's office.